Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And I think it's safe to say, in a lot of ways, if not for tonight's guest, there may be no Banal of America, because he was one of the first people, he was the first person, you know, like, who's ever been on the show as a guest, or you know, anybody in the field, whoever like, gave me the time of day, you know, whoever, like, hung out with me at the first ever X conference back in 2004, and I was sort of, this is like, to show my naivete about this field, I, like, showed up thinking I could get a job somehow. It was like, Jesus, dude, I look back on that, like, I had resumes. I'm like, what am I, an asshole? Now I'm like, what are you, insane and all? You can't get a job like that in fucking this crazy field. So, for folks who don't know, this was like the Woodstock of the paranormal, the first X conference, or the Woodstock of ufology. It was like insane. Jim Mars was there. That's where I first met Jim Mars. Rich Hoagland was there. Linda Moulton Howe. Oh, Nick Pope. I'm trying to think. Tim Good. All kinds of people. I'd have to look at a blabber. And of course, our guest tonight, Peter Robbins. Longtime UFO researcher. He spent a lot of time looking at the Rendlesham Forest incident. He wrote a book about it. And he's does the circuit. He's all over the place. He's been writing about this topic for years. He worked with Bud Hopkins back in the 80s. You know, he's just sort of like this venerable, beloved figure that's been in the field for years. And I think why people like him so much is because he gives... You know, he talks to everybody. You know, he's very, you know, when you talk to him, you're like the only person in the room, and he really treats you with respect, even if you're just some up-and-comer. And that's what I was at the time when I met him. I was like, you know, just hanging out at the bar at the hotel in Gaithersburg, and Peter and I hung out and chatted all night, and I was like, all right, this field's pretty cool, man. They're not all, like, crazy, like, quasi-celebrity wannabes. So it was, that kind of made me stick with this. And I'll always, forever hold him in gratitude for that. So welcome back to the show, Peter. Thank you, man. Like I said, I think if I had gone home and not made it that thing, I probably would have been like, yeah, it was cool, but these people are kind of unfriendly. So I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I've created a monster. And a great monster. It's great to be back on the show, Tim.
Thanks, man. I meant what I said, though, dude, for real. Like, if not for that, it was a real critical sort of critical moment in the course of this whole thing. So, you know.
You know, for me, there's an aphorism. It sounds a little corny, but giving is its own reward. I've always found that it's true. Not only that, but we're all in this together, and that's not a catchphrase. I have very little patience for prima donnas, people that do good work and are available for other people in my heart. Mm. And the fact is that other people did this for me when I wasn't even a blip on the map. I reached out to people I admired in the field who are well-known, and with almost no exceptions, they encouraged me, supported me, helped me out, helped give me confidence in doing what I was doing, and, you know, pay it forward.
There you go.
It's the way it should be, but unfortunately, it's not always the way it is.
No, no. And to the and to the yeah, like I said, my naivete in a sense to the in the defense, I would say, yeah, of the Uber stars of the X Conference of 2004, it was like, I've been to these. I remember I saw you in Exeter. I was laughing about this. I saw you in Exeter this past summer, and
that's right.
And I said, I was talking to my friend George. I think you met George.
Yes.
And I said, it was a meet and greet, but like these ufology meet and greets turn into like a high school dance in a sense, where it's like there's not a lot of moving around.
Pretty much. I think the other thing is those of us that put ourselves forward into the public realm here, some of us feel the obligation, the honor of being in that position comes with an obligation, and hopefully one that you enjoy, of being available to hang and to talk and to make new friends, to be there for them as other people were there for you, and to do all we can to keep this topic going more and more mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's like for those, like I said, for those Uber stars, I can understand now maybe they would be less chatty because you can't move like 10 feet in some of these events. Someone comes up and talks to you.
Sometimes. And yeah. We have to be careful too that we don't get into allowing ourselves to be monopolized, because there are other folks that want to speak with us that we want to speak to. And for each, you know, person that you do really connect with, there is the beginning of another potential friendship or colleagueship or just time well spent.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's why, you know, I've recommended you to people who, you know, put on events and stuff, because it's like,
thank
I think you. Of you as a great ambassador of the field, you know, because I'm just not, you know, I'm the kind of person, I'm not very good with strangers in that sense,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you're very giving, and I'm always like, if you want someone who really, you know, the audience is going to go home and be like, wow, that guy was awesome, you know, I'm like, get Peter Robbins, because he, you know, he connects with like every person he talks to, so.
I'm going to send you a $10 bill. I hope it doesn't get lost in the mail.
Oh. I'll send you a $10 invoice.
Perfect.
But, yeah, talking about making this stuff more popular, I feel beholden in a sense first to ask about this, and I don't know, I'm sure you probably do interviews, you know, where it's come up. Have you talked about, have you, what do you think of this stuff from the Pentagon and everything in December?
In a Mr. Spock kind of eyebrow-raising, chin-rubbing way, fascinating, Captain. The fact is that this has happened repeatedly for decades, where a major media venue publishes a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seen as a huge breakthrough sometimes because we associate that venue, in this case, the venerable gray lady herself, the New York Times. Not only did they publish two worthy articles in December. One was on the front page, at least the first part. And it led into this whole thing that has happened. I guess the best known person that we associate with this turn in the road is Tom DeLonge.
Right, yeah.
Who is likeable enough, seems sincere. I wish him well, and we'll see what happens. The thing is that the Times itself, though, which is emblematic of major media, covered the story very much with the same pattern that they've used since the summer of 1947. And I say that as possibly the only person you will ever know who has read every single article, commentary, letter to the editor, editorial, photo caption relative to the flying saucer/UFO subject that the New York Times has ever printed.
I forgot that you had done that deep dive. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. So this
and,
is the perfect person to talk to, folks. Yeah, exactly.
It really
yeah.
was an interesting thing. Their basic strategy from the start, and they really led the way for major media to create what I would call the ridicule factor. And it was locked down. It was done. It was absolutely sealed, not by the end of the summer of 47, but by the end of July. They slammed away so hard and so dramatically and so consistently at the subject with condescension, with sarcasm, with pseudoscience, with skepticism that bordered on insulting the figures that they bring forward, especially in the early years. We'd like to quote this authority. The authority is almost always a psychologist or a astronomer, often not named. And again, it's fascinating, and it worked brilliantly. The rest of the major media, which at the time consisted almost exclusively of newspapers and a few major broadcast news organizations. Again, we're talking about before television here, so we had NBC leading the way, David Sarnoff coming out of Rockefeller Center, and then CBS. ABC wasn't even a glint in its mother's eye at the time, and America bought it, and by extension, the world did as well. So in this coverage in December, they lay it out with some respectability, and in this case, we had kind of a secret weapon in there that two of the three authors of that main piece in the Times had experience in the work and already took it seriously. One was Leslie Kane, who is actually a real-life journalist who got involved in ufology as opposed to people like me, who are self-trained investigative writers and trained ourselves to do that because of our obsession with the subject.
Right.
The other was a Times staff writer named Ralph Blumenthal, who also has done some good coverage of the subject. But once again, toward the end, they trot out the skeptical possibilities and the what-ifs. The second piece was also of great interest to me because it discussed the experiences of two military pilots who had been scrambled and got close enough to see what they were looking at was not a friggin' airplane, and had the courage to make that report. For those of us in the work, there are countless credible military accounts, but to see it in the Times impressed me. And again, then it was followed a week later with an editorial by an otherwise usually competent, obviously intelligent writer for the Times, Ross Duault, who once again reduced the whole subject back to a 1947 perspective of it could be this, it could be that, we don't know about this. Of course, if it was real, we'd all know about it now. And, you know, the New York Times still carries weight in this world.
Yeah.
So meet the new boss, same as the old boss as far as that goes. But it was an awful coverage, no question about it. And it got people talking and for some people maybe allowed them the grace to allow themselves to take the subject a little more seriously because this establishment monolith is publishing around it with a hint of seriousness.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that kind of come through out of that coverage since December, where it's like this they seem to be taking it a little more seriously. It's interesting. It's certainly interesting. I mean, I don't quite know what to make of it just yet because it feels like it's still unfolding. You know what I mean? At least I hope it is.
There's no question. And what we're either going to see over the next months or longer is a genuine turn in the road based on this kind of juggernaut that Tom seems to be heading. I'm always circumspect when I learn that there is a business built into it and money is changing hands. Not that that in itself in any way should put a damper on the subject, but it just makes you want to keep a closer eye on it. I certainly, coming from an optimistic perspective and always trying to have a positive outlook until I learn otherwise, and then God help anybody that's in my way as far as being a naysayer on what is obviously the truth. I wish him well. I hope that he produces the results that we're all hoping for and creates a wider audience. I think sometimes when a figure from popular culture comes forward and says, you know, I had a sighting, or I take it seriously, or I believe, and that includes everybody from Elvis to Dan Aykroyd to, my God, it's literally a pantheon of people
yeah.
In popular culture, Muhammad Ali, you know, it causes a momentary blip on the radar for some. But this is not that. Tom, who brings certainly a segment of his rock and roll audience with him from Blink 182, who, for many people, they're waiting for somebody that they, you know, see as an iconoclast, admire in popular culture, like their art or their music. And if they turn political or something, then there's a chance that they will listen to them more than an established political figure, historian, scientist,
right,
what have you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting. It seems to – I just see a lot of interesting attitudes from ufology about it. You know, where it's like I'm trying to remain sort of agnostic about it. You know what I mean? I'm skeptical because it's like we've seen this a million times, like
sure.
You said, you know. But it's like there's also this backlash where it's like, can't you just appreciate what you're getting? You know? I don't know if you've seen that kind of thing where it's like,
yeah,
this is a good thing for us. Shut up and go along with it. And it's like
it's a good thing. But we are in the work, are famous for squabbling,
exactly,
splitting infinitives, having pet theories that we like to nurse along. There is a phrase that when you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. Obviously, that's not true, but allegorically, I know that you and our audience know what I mean. And for me, starting at the very beginning, 40 years ago, when my late great sister Helen shared with me her abduction-related memories at a time when, you know, I know that Betty and Barney Hill were in the culture, but I could have cared less about the whole thing. I was an artist in New York, and that's what I was going to stay and become famous and a great painter, and it evaporated when this other thing came charging into my life. But you had mentioned Bud before, bless his heart. Bud Hopkins, arguably the father of modern scientific abduction-related research, which certainly is the most disturbing, complex, and I think important aspect of the research, and for outsiders, the most ludicrous and the hardest to grasp, except if you're one of the several million people that's had this kind of experience happen to them. And we connected about a year after I became involved, and this would have been in about 1976, 5 years before he had published his first book, when we were both painters with an interest in the subject, living in New York, and became friends. The friendship grew over the years, and by 87, when he published Intruders, after he had published Missing Time, a very important book, both of them actually, 81 and 87, and his life exploded. He needed help. And it was a wonderful friendship, and I was glad to help. I knew it was important work. I found it fascinating, and I had the privilege of working as his assistant for on and off for most of the time between the mid-'80s and 2000, when my sister died, and I went into the tank for a prolonged period of time. And when I came out, he had very wisely replaced me with another one of our Intruders Foundation board members who is doing a great job. So the last years of our acquaintanceship returned to the first years of our friendship where, you know, I would spend time there regularly, hang out and do what we did that first time in his kitchen, sit at the table, drink coffee, and talk about art, life, and UFOs. And when he got sick, I helped out as much as I could. And I still think about him every day, a remarkable man, a great guy as well as a great man. His work remains very important and worth reading, and I just feel very fortunate that I had the chance that I did to be a bug on the wall for all those years.
For sure. Now, it's interesting to think about. I was thinking of this before we sat down to talk tonight. It's like we met maybe like 15 years ago,
and right.
You know, I guess in 15 years, we may look back and be like, well, it was funny. Things have changed because of this thing. Without putting too much stock
into
this Pentagon thing, it's like we haven't – nothing between 2004 and now, like really nothing had changed. We haven't gotten any closer to the answer to this. It's pretty remarkable in a sense. You know, it used to kind of frustrate me and worry me and sort of jumping off kind of what you said about about Bud and everything, it's like when Jim Mars passed away this summer, he was sort of like this mentor to me. And it kind of like finally drove the nail or the hammer or whatever, closed the lid, I guess, in my mind or something, that it was like, all right, I may get through this whole life and not find out any answers to this. You know, like, you know, I think up until Jim died this summer, I was like, I'll probably find out, you know. But when that happened, I was like, all right, I'm getting to that age now where more people I know are dying.
I know, the nerve.
yeah. It's like, it's
a
spooky feeling.
To digress for a moment, the great Sacha Baron Cohen, who broke in years ago with an unforgettable character, Ali G, the white rapper with about the three brain cells, who did this phenomenal mock show in Britain that for the first season was doubly remarkable because many of his guests, who were very important people in public life, accepted it, not realizing the show was a satire or that he was a master of, you know, maintaining this character where behind it is a brilliant comic mind and a real scholar. And I just have to relate this. At one point, he had on as his guest at that time the fairly recently retired former not attorney general, chief doctor, what's it called?
Surgeon general?
Surgeon general, yes, exactly. C. Everett Koop, who we all remember from his kind of Lincoln-esque beard. And one thing is leading to another, and at a certain point, Koop remarks that, well, you know, everybody dies. And the camera goes to Cohen's face, and it is a blank. It is what you see is somebody realizing for the first time, of course, that this may actually include him.
His response
is, everybody?
And
he engages him on that for a while, and that epiphany that you just described, I remember hitting it 15, 20 years ago and saying, I may well not learn the answers to the questions that I began seeking in the mid-70s. I've now, you know, seen some of the older generation move on to whatever comes next, and gosh, it is possible that I'm going to miss the boat on this. How do I feel about that? That is the important thing, and what I realized was I feel fine about it. I didn't get into this because I love it. I got into it because I was obsessed with it. I love the arts. I love photography. I love New York City. I love traveling. I love my friends. I love nature, but I don't love UFO studies. I think it's important. I think I've been able to make some contributions. I pride myself on being a good communicator, and I'm not afraid to answer more questions than some of my colleagues with the response, I don't know.
Right.
And never fake anything. We're all feeling our way through this, like that wonderful idea of the seven blind men feeling around an elephant, and each one describing very different things and having very different definitions of what that creature is that they're on, whether or not you're at the trunk end, the rear, the side, the tusk, whatever.
Yeah.
We don't know. And we, you know, what I can say at this point after 40 years is I know we are not alone in the universe. I think that at this point it's become somewhat stylish to suggest that, well, there are so many alternatives that this phenomena may be. And having pioneered that idea, the great Jacques Vallée and a handful of other people, one would be John Keel, offering other explanations as opposed to the extraterrestrial. For me, there's literally no doubt that some of this UFO-related phenomena is indeed extraterrestrial in nature. The rest of it, who the hell knows? And I'm open to anything. I am perfectly comfortable with that attitude. I will always be a seeker in this. I think we have, you know, a history of a study where we are all trying to self-educate ourselves, where some people know or feel they know some of the answers, and some of them may, in fact, have them. As Bud used to remark, why should we trust them any more than the aliens? And at the same time, deception seems to run as a very strong thread through the abduction phenomena, through the contact phenomena. Not that, you know, they are not as they represent themselves to some people, or that they represent themselves to some people in certain manners that simply are not accurate. They may well be as involved in deception and misleading and not being honest as, well, we human beings are. And I don't want to sound, you know, like a burnt-out skeptic or anything. I am open to anything.
Yeah.
There are wonderful contributors to the field, but I think when I see some of the new guards saying it's anything but extraterrestrial, I have to smile and shake my head. It's akin to saying I know the unknown. And
yeah, I know you.
There's an intellectual arrogance there, and the journey should be the thing, because we may not get there or get there together. And if you are not engaged in the journey of learning and educating yourself and networking and putting your views forward to be challenged or to be changed by good arguments, logic, proof, you should probably be doing something else.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's a lot of that, there wouldn't be too many people left in ufology if they took up your advice.
Possibly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know what you mean in a sense where you hit the nail on the head with the word stylish. Yeah, it's like it's the in thing to be, you know, to just to be like steadfast in the to show your credibility, your hipster card or whatever, where it's like the ETH is bullshit, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's everything but the ETH. You know, it's like I've always held a soft spot for it. And you know, anytime I have a conversation with somebody on the show, you know, I always just go back to that template scenario in discussing this whole topic, because to me, it's like that makes the most sense.
Yeah. One of the things in coming up through the ranks was dealing with not skeptics. We should all be skeptics and hardcore. I'm from Missouri. Show me something. The iconic X-Files poster, which blew into our consciousness transom in the early 90s, featured four words which have embedded themselves in popular culture, not just in this country, but around the world. I want to believe. And I was in Greece this past summer, again, speaking at a conference there. I love Greece. And there is a community of wonderful people. They're very involved in the work of Wilhelm Reich, which has captured my imagination from the time I was a teenager, and which I am still very involved in. And one of my colleagues there, in bringing up this I want to believe mantra, which for so many of us is filled with mystical longing and hope and fear and all that, and he said, no, I don't want to believe, I want to know. I thought, well said. But there is that part of us that longs for these deep, deep truths and knowledge that is not accessible. So some people get frustrated. They make a decision that it is this, that, or the other thing, and do their best to put forward that agenda. For me, you follow the path where it goes, and what you're able to put forward as evidence is as good as it gets, and you may always be wrong. The important thing there is when you are to own up to it as publicly, as quickly, and as fully as possible, and get on with your work.
Well, again, that's this should be like advice for all all the people in ufology. Yeah, yeah. If you're wrong about something, just be cool about it.
At the same time, we're talking about people who, in many cases, I adore, who are friends.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And at the same time, you know, we go at it and have a little fun at each other's expense sometimes. If you can't have that kind of humor, I just feel sorry for you. I think the highest form of humor is that, having fun at your own expense rather than somebody else's. But because the work is fraught with anxiety, with conflict, with extraordinarily overwhelming implications for humanity, there are times that it can be overwhelming. And I'm not just talking about people who have legitimate contact for abduction experiences, I'm talking about those of us that do the work too. I've had periods where I've had to manage my own anxiety, and you know, you move through it.
Yeah.
And just keep going.
Yeah, exactly. I forgot where. I lost my train of thought there on that, but
it derailed.
There you go. I'm open to all these other theories as well. You know what I mean? But to me, it's like it has become a little too fashionable to be like, well, the ETH can't be it because for some,
yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, that's, you know, it has to be included still.
Here's a mantra that I came up with years ago, and it revolved around Bud Hopkins' dealings with a person who has a very major reputation in ufology for decades until he moved on, which is Philip Klass as the debunker in chief. Philip, we now know, was paid to do his work, and was a son of a bitch, but also very charming in his own way. And again, it's to take the time to address every skeptic that comes at you if you're involved, especially in controversial work, will drain you. But to not address debunkers or skeptics who are smart, but their agenda is to bring you down, because the mantra for debunking for me is it can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else. And my job, self-assigned, of course, is to pat you on the head and explain to you how what you think it is can't be, because I can't handle that possibility, frankly, parenthetically. So it could be this, that, or the other thing, everything from movement in the sky in some strange weather formation or a misinterpretation of a conventional object, all very true. I think if we were able to have accurate statistics going back to, let's say, the beginning of the modern age of UFO, which kicked in ferociously in the summer of 47, we might be amazed that so few, quote-unquote, flying saucer / UFO sightings accounts were explainable in conventional terms, no matter how exotic, now more than ever, because we human beings have stuff up there that mimics, you know, our images from science fiction or very likely advanced technology from parts unknown that come and go with impunity. And you do have to take the time to address in hyper detail attacks sometimes, even though you'd rather be doing something else with your time.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's part of the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the field. It's like,
yep.
Phil Klass leaves and, you know, Bill Nye comes along. So it's
yep.
like they just keep – they replace each other, you know, generationally just like just like ufology. It's like Tom and Jerry.
You bet.
So it's interesting. But it does make me wonder I did kind of appreciate, in a sense, we did get a victory for all – you know, I know a lot of people – are super skeptical about this Pentagon thing, but we can definitely chalk up a victory in the sense that, like, they had a secret program and no one really knew about it. So
yeah. So
all the skeptics who say, have said all these years, like, they could never keep anything like that a secret. It's like, well, they did. They did. We know for sure because we just found out that they had this secret program.
Well, absolutely. And that argument, I think, is a very active one, going back to the dawn of this subject. When I first got involved, my best foil for bouncing ideas off of to challenge me, and as a result to make me go back and sharpen my arguments with factual information, present documents, and be a better debater, a art that seems to be disappearing from our education system, which is tragic, that was my dad's argument. He was served in World War II in the Army Air Corps, and I had an aunt who was a secretary at the Manhattan Project. My dad's thing was, you know, if this were real, there would have been leaks over the years. And my ultimate argument was there have been hundreds of leaks, but what happens to them? They end up as a paper published, you know, originally in some mimeographed journal of that, you know, has 40 subscribers, or is a talk that somebody gives at a library, or ultimately, if you get into the big leagues, a major presentation at the UFO Congress or the International MUFON Symposium. But still, we're a tiny fraction of the world at large.
Right, right.
And it's easy to see us as cultists or believers or, you know, all of the superficial, insulting terms that people toss at people who make them uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It was, we're not going to, you need like help in getting sort of the word out. That's why this whole thing was interesting in a sense. I don't know what it says about the world, but it's like, to me, it was interesting in a lot of ways because this is sort of like going to these get off my lawn things where as I get older, I'm surprised to see like younger people, but it's like, it seemed like to a lot of people online, not in the UFO bubble of like our Facebook community respectively, but just sort of like in media and stuff,
yes.
You know, bloggers and tweeters and all that shit. Sports writers, entertainment people like that too, not just people in our field. A lot of people were like, hey, the government just announced that the aliens are, the UFOs are real and stuff. Like it was taken as, in a sense, sort of a limited hangout disclosure in a way to younger people.
Yeah. Well, what really happened was some good research and investigation revealed that in 2004, as I recall, a program went into effect that was funded to the tune of a little over $20 million to study this subject in relative secrecy. These things have probably happened repeatedly within different agencies, offices, et cetera.
One would think.
But this is the one that made the papers, and it involved real elected officials whose names that we know. For that, that first wave, when you realize that these are, my gosh, these aren't ufologists, these are senators. This is a
right. Yeah, exactly.
Level
yeah.
of the game, and I'm excited. I remember 30 years ago, there was a major MUFON symposium in 87 that marked the 40th anniversary of Roswell, Kenneth Arnold, and modern age of UFOs, so to say. And they had their symposium in Washington, D.C. at American University. And there was a buzz in the audience at a certain point at a break that Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island was in the audience. And a number of us, you know, were intrigued. And not long after that, later that afternoon, myself and a number of friends came upon him at a break. There he was with his name tag. There was no question. A good and decent guy, best known for the educational grants that hold his name still. And we asked him, you know, what are you doing here, Senator? And his response, given very easily, was, as a private citizen, I'm as interested in this as anybody, which certainly may well have been true.
That's amazing.
We're talking about a ranking American senator.
Yeah, I can't even imagine like that happening today. That would be like stunning.
It was exciting. It was exciting because, you know, you turn around and there's Stanton Friedman, Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and a lot of the people who were pantheons of the work at the time. And here is somebody who is emblematic of the establishment. And, of course, at the time you think, wow, this is a hopeful sign. Who knows who's going to come up next? Well, good luck on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's been many start and stops. I guess the point I was making in a sense in the get off my lawn thing where it was almost like people, these younger people, it seemed like they were, who knows, they're online, but it's like, or at least less cynical about the subject than I am because I've been looking at it for all these years. They were just kind of like blasé about it. They were like, oh, okay, UFOs are real. All right. You know, there wasn't any. It didn't shatter the world like a lot of people have suspected. I hope that's a good sign if this is some kind of like planned thing that like people didn't freak out. They were more kind of just like the general reaction I got was like, huh, that's interesting, you know. And also sort of like, can you believe this world is so crazy that they just announced this and no one seems like, and you know, it was already. Within a week, it was like we're all too busy dealing with Donald Trump right now. We don't have time for aliens.
True. He takes up all the air in the room, and people have asked me if I think that disclosure per se is any more or any less likely under this administration. My feeling is it is absolutely no more likely than it has been since Harry Truman. One thing that we tend to forget, things have changed so much since this phenomena happened in so many respects in human experience, popular culture, society, population, etc. Truman, and I'd include Eisenhower, were the last two American presidents to probably know about as much about this as any American president has, and their stay the course attitude, I understand and appreciate now rather than when I was younger, and power to the people, and, you know, let us have the information, we can handle it, and we're not weighing all the factors they are. But at this point, if any American president were to ever come forward, I mean, naive as it is to even consider at this point in history that one world leader could simply spring this on the world, although let us not count out the president of China, who now, as of this week, may be president for the rest of his life.
Yes.
How wonderful that is. And Mr. Putin, even as just a political way to take another leadership position as we become more and more insular here in the States. But we have to remember that party affiliations, what we'll call conservatism or liberalism, are asides when you are a member of that very exclusive club of being president. And whether it had been President Obama or now President Trump, imagine, you know, coming forward one night, my fellow Americans, it's my solemn duty to inform you, blah, blah, blah. It's never going to happen because
right.
with that statement, they would be having to admit that every American president, many of them who we hold in great esteem, depending on our political views and philosophical attitudes, whether they're Democratic Party or Republicans, whether they're arch-conservatives or, you know, left-wing liberals, every American president is an unindicted co-conspirator in the greatest cover-up in the history of the world, period.
Right, right.
And that's a touchy thing. So don't
maybe that's what would bring them. Maybe that's the one thing that would bring the country together at this
well,
point.
Well, yes, I think it might. And I remember I wasn't involved in the work at the time, but at a point in the 70s, I'm trying to remember who was the first one to introduce it to me, but it wasn't Friedman, but the idea that as we were coming toward Watergate in 71 or so, 72, the idea started to gain traction in ufology that Nixon, who now seems like an elder statesman and a major intellect, a paranoid, but, you know, he wasn't stupid, that Nixon, feeling more and more cornered, might pull the plug on this, because if he did, all of a sudden it would be like, wait a minute, what, we're being visited by aliens or by other intelligences from different dimensions or what have you?
Right.
We've got to stick with the guy that we have. This is no time for an impeachment. Of course, that didn't happen. I think that the only way that a president of the United States, and I say that as opposed to other first world leaders, would ever even consider this is if they knew their hand was going to be forced, whether by earthly forces of another world leader saying I'm going to be the one to do it, or by them. There was, in the 80s, an absolutely mediocre miniseries that in the, I guess the 10 years ago or so or less, was redone, spending more money, and just as hokey, called V, like V.
Oh, you didn't like V?
Yeah. I thought after a very short time, it had it basically becomes every World War II resistance movie.
Right, yeah,
with the aliens being the Nazis and,
right,
you know, the human beings being the Jews. And at the same time, I thought that the beginning, the premise, the opening of the story was brilliant beyond words, was as fine a science fiction construct as I have ever imagined, worthy of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Arthur C. Clarke, Gene Roddenberry, and it was simply this. One morning, everybody on the planet wakes up, and guess what? over the 60 biggest cities, 1 mile up, is a giant honking mile-across mothership. Game over. From there, it was all downhill.
Right, but I agree. I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so the premise was great, and then it became like, yeah.
People like me will say sometimes that, you know, disclosure has been coming since 1947, 1, 2, 7, 18 people at a time.
Right.
Who, they used to say that a conservative is a liberal that has been mugged, and at least in New York, forget about it.
I've never heard that one. That's good. Like that.
One could say that a UFO skeptic, I hate the word believer, but somebody who takes the subject.
An advocate.
Yes, absolutely, seriously, may well be somebody who used to joke about it, but has had an experience, a sighting, or knows somebody that they would trust with their life who's confided to them something similar. So it is changing. It's changing arithmetically, but not geometrically. And I know there are some in the field that would love if we could develop the critical mass within our population whereby there would be enough oomph to begin to create like an anti-Vietnam War kind of movement.
Right.
And having lived through that and been a part of it, it was very dramatic. It wasn't just us, you know, 20-year-olds marching in the streets. It was our parents. It was Walter Cronkite. It was the Attorney General of the United States, and then everything changed. I don't see that happening unless something unforeseen happens, and in that case, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing that has prevented the subject from really ever getting that sort of, like, cultural cachet is that, like, no one's life depends on this, you know? And I mean, like, that, the aliens may be laughing at that because they may be like, oh, if you only knew, you know? But as far as we know, you know, it's like I get up and go to work every day and nothing would change if there were aliens or not. But it's like,
right.
You know, being sent off to war or, you know, having the right to vote or having the right to get married. These are real, like, important issues, you know. To real issues.
I think that many people go through kind of a tunnel of changes on this if they become, like I did when I was younger, obsessed with the subject. And in my first few years, I literally went into therapy over this because I was so obsessed. It was not just my sister's sharing these memories with me, and I had no reason to doubt her, and I still don't. In fact, now her very words and her drawings and her descriptions, I've heard them hundreds of times, sometimes word for word, from people not just all over this country, but in many other countries. And part of what consumed me was this is happening, and I'm living in a schizophrenic world where there are those of us that know or suspect that things are not as they seem in a very dramatic way, and other people who are, you know, among them the kindest, most thoughtful, considerate, responsible people, paying their taxes, doing their best to raise healthy kids, paying their mortgages, making friendships, putting money away for, you know, when they're older, but they're sleepwalking. They have no idea. And I would regularly be walking down a street in New York and being a filmatic person, a film lover since I was a young child. My mind would literally go into a split screen. And on one side would be me in the moment walking down East 23rd Street to my teaching job at the School of Visual Arts. On the other side of the screen was me as Kevin McCarthy at the end of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers standing in the highway screaming, "They're here! You're next! They're here!" I dealt with it and moved on, but one has to make their peace with these things. And if you express those passionate views too passionately to the wrong person, you are not only not going to get an advocate or create the possibility for another person to take this subject seriously, it's just going to reinforce for them that caricature archetype of, you know, you're a crazy person, basically, and you believe this, and you want other people to believe it to back up. It becomes, you know, kind of an allegory to religion. I believe it. I don't need proof. I know it's true. They're there. And if you don't believe it, you know, you're a fool.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's not like a life or death issue. It's like, you know, we don't really, you know, it's a fascinating sort of quirk of the world or something. I don't know what else, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's just a weird little, big thing. I don't know, you know, it's just like a weird sort of hanging thing that's hanging over us that it's like, no pun intended, because it's the UFO. But it's like, but at the end of the day, everyone just kind of has to go along with whatever, you know, happens.
Yeah, that is really what it comes down to sometimes. We need to roll with the punches, be open-minded, but above all else, live your life. Live as full a life as you can. Make friends. Fight for what you believe in. And don't take shit from people. Stand up for your beliefs. Engage people. But if you stop the flow of what's best about living a human life, falling in love, having adventures, seeing a great movie, having a wonderful meal, getting a goal that you had aimed for, you know, buying your own home or getting a new car, there's a kind of sadness to it. I would hate to, I'm sitting here in my office right now and I'm looking at, I'll say one of the damn best UFO libraries in the country. I mean, I've been building it since I got involved. And I love books. I'm a big reader. I always was. Grew up in a reading family. But I have so many interests in life, so many things that I passionately enjoy. My roommate, as you know, is my dad, who is well in his 90s. He is a remarkable guy. He just published a memoir that he began at 95 and finished at 97.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. Alan Robbins, a Ordinary Man, available now in Kindle and regular edition on from Amazon.
Awesome.
My dad's a great guy. He takes all this stuff seriously, open-minded. But I just lost my train of thought. That's not fair. What was I saying?
This is you're talking about your dad. You're talking about in your office. You're looking at your books. Let me see. I'm trying to see how far back I.
Oh yeah. Just that. When I do research, I go online like everybody does, but I don't have to rely on, you know, some alleged thing that somebody says that we don't even know their real name, that they can't back up, that there's no fully documented proof. I encourage people to build their, dare I say, analog actual book libraries, and at the same time, having a good time.
Oh, that was it, yes.
Yeah, at 97, he still, you know, is living his life. He's still, you know, curious to know what's going to happen the next day. As he says, I want to see how things turn out. Now, that might keep him going for, you know, another century or two. Who knows?
Yeah, no kidding. The way things are going nowadays,
yeah.
It's like
but the
life is a cliffhanger.
I know people in the work, and many of them dear, wonderful people, but who go through periods at least where they take themselves so seriously and are so locked into this subject and don't want people, it seems like the best way to put yourself forward as a serious professional is, you know, have your strictly professional website, your strictly UFO-related Facebook page. You know, talk about other subjects quietly with friends, but stick to the topic and only associate yourself publicly with that. I mean, if that's the defining way that we make our judgments, I lost it years ago with, you know, my 1,000th cat video. I'm such a cat sucker. And, you know, the history of New York and ancient history and fossils and human psychology and you know, the world is so exciting, even in this crazy era where we don't feel as comfortable traveling to places that I was lucky enough to visit when I was young and, you know, fall in love with being a citizen of the world and having courage and, you know, traveling for a year on my own without knowing how things were going to turn out and getting into adventures, and some of them a little scary, some of them not. But if you're afraid to live that part of your life, or you feel that, gee, if I show too much of my non-professional, non-UFO-related side, people won't take me as seriously.
Oh, God.
Well,
nobody takes any of this shit seriously outside of this, outside of the people in it. It's like, yeah, that's like, you know, that's like a professional wrestler wanting to be admired by his peers. It's like, I guess that's an admirable trait, but at the same time, you're still just a wrestler.
Yeah, I remember when the wonderful, wonderful fake documentary in the defining word of the brilliant director, creator, Rob Reiner, the mockumentary of the Spinal Tap.
Oh, yeah, classic.
Yes. At the very end, you may remember part of the whole plot is that all of their drummers keep dying mysterious deaths, and you know, that the police department really didn't even want to look into it because it was, well, a little too weird. At the end, there is this micro interview with their current final drummer, and he gives the interview right before he explodes and is just a little bit of, like, sticky jelly left on the drummer's seat. And Reiner asks him, what's your philosophy of life? And he looks at the camera and he says, quote, unquote, have a good time all the time. I love that line. I don't have a good time all the time, but I do whenever I can. And it tempers the seriousness that I do live with very often in my professional work.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. If you're not having fun in this, I mean, come on. It's like the craziest, weirdest thing out there.
Yeah.
And like I said, I mean, even if it feels like life and death, it's really not, folks, because nothing really affecting us in that way.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Travis Walton, who I'm lucky enough to count as a dear friend as well as an esteemed colleague, last year, I'm sure he said it before, but the question came up about, you know, anxiety, fear of what all of this is leading to and what's it about. And his thing was, look, if, you know, they really are, in so many words, bad, malignant, evil, you know, I don't see the signs of it. I mean, nobody's messing with me.
Right, right.
We're all living our lives, and, you know, if this is the way it is, we can speculate about the deep state, the secret government, all of this until we're blue in the face. But being here right now, if things were, you know, as bad as they could be, I would probably be about 12 miles from here underneath Lake Cayuga in the salt mine, wearing a little brain hat on my head, looking straight ahead with no emotion, and mining salt for the aliens. That is not the case. And it's one of the things that gets me down sometimes, that people get so over-serious in the subject. And I'm one of them. I've certainly been through those periods.
But things make you angry or something like that. Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Right. But there's a great Sicilian proverb that I subscribe to, which is, living well is the best revenge. And we should all be doing our best to live as well as we can. And I don't just mean going out to expensive restaurants or, you know, having toys that, you know, the world admires, but being a person of goodwill. Like Thoreau, kindness should be part of our religion. There should always be room for generosity. And it's karma. You know, what you do comes back to you, as one of my Sister Helen's song lyrics went.
Yeah.
And I live by that.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the sort of note of words of wisdom, in a sense, and kind of like what you're talking about, it's like I was reading a completely unrelated sort of message board thing where somebody, you're talking about some wrestling topic or whatever, and it was like the person said, what really pisses me off is that I can imagine a situation where they're saying and blah, 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 and the next person that responded was like, you really shouldn't get so upset about scenarios that you imagined in your own mind.
Well said.
I know, and it was like, oh, my God. Like, that could apply to so many, like, that could apply to so many instances in my own life where it was like, I've never sort of seen it spelled out so clearly before, but it's like, that's pretty true, you know. There's plenty of times when I sort of imagine things that I think might be the case, and it gets me mad, and then it's like, What do you, whether it's UFOs, life, women, whatever, you know, it's like, what, why are you getting so upset about something that you're imagining might be the case? That's, you know, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And it's a shame, too.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part of human nature, though. It's like a paranoia thing, but it's like you need to check yourself in a sense and be like,
yeah,
wait a minute. You know, I only imagine, like, maybe they're not, like, gathering in some secret cabal to keep the UFO secret from us, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, why am I getting so pissed off about that?
Yeah, and if they are, like Tony Soprano would have said, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Except watch an episode of The Sopranos, perhaps. If you've, again, you know, point made, but if you're not living as full a life as you can, whatever you're doing, you're missing out on things, and that's a shame.
Now, you're a fastidious researcher of all this stuff, as we've established here. You're talking about your giant library and everything. Have you ever, is there anything like outside the realm of UFOs that's sort of, I mean, not like pop culture, I mean like paranormal-wise, that's like captured? Like, because I, you know, if somebody asked me, I'd be like, I'm a dual major of UFOs and Bigfoot. So it's like, I'm almost as well-versed in Bigfoot as I am in UFOs, because those are my two main sort of things. But is there anything, you know, did you ever take, like, an interest in, like, I don't know, psychic mediumship or Bigfoot or ghosts or anything, like, beyond, you know, the UFOs and sort of abduction stuff?
Great question. If this were the 80s and you asked me that question, I would probably try to work my way around it, because one of the ways that skeptics and debunkers had of coming at us was, oh, you're into reincarnation and ancient mysteries and ghosts and hauntings, as well as UFOs. It is a rather insulting and obvious strategy to suggest that you are something of an airhead and, a big-eyed goofball who will be suckered into any strange-sounding thing.
Yeah.
The answer is absolutely yes. Oh, yes. I had one or two experiences growing up, which I've never been able to compartmentalize and just realize that things are not as they seem. I have never had my own ghost or spirit experience per se, but there are people who I would trust with my life who have. And I have seen what I consider credible evidence to consider what's generally called reincarnation as factual. I never saw it, nor do I see it as mystical. I see it as like physics. Let's call it the law of transmigration of souls, that 100 years from now they'll be able to calibrate and measure in a laboratory. The ancient mysteries, how things were engineered that we can't even do now, moving, you know, giant stones from X to Y location. And Baalbek, the plains of Baalbek, gosh, is that in Saudi or Syria? I'm embarrassed to say I forget. There are hewn stones that are 60 tons or more. That's nuts.
Yeah.
When I was young, I was adventurous, and it, as I said before, it was a time when you could put a pack on your back, and if you had some bucks in your pocket and could get away from home, you could see areas of the world that would lead you to think more about these things in future. I roamed over good parts of Afghanistan all by myself when it was still a peaceful kingdom.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
When was this?
Early 70s.
Jesus.
I roamed around India for almost 4 months on my own.
My God.
Taking buses, hitchhiking, at one point riding an elephant from point A to point B. Not
what?
A ride, but it was the only way to get where I was going. I rode on the roof car, the roof of a train for 3 days, going from Calcutta to a hill station entry point called Roxol into Nepal. I hiked almost to the Tibetan border, all on my own. Went through the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. Iraq, traveled in Iran twice. And
how old were you? Were you like in your 20s?
I was 24.
Wow.
And I had the time of my life, and which almost I was separated from almost several times, but I wasn't. I I'm not a mystical thinking person. I never felt, you know, I was being watched over by angels, but I did remember my mother's bell jar, you know, the glass cover that goes on a wooden board that you keep cheese under.
And, oh, yeah.
And there were times I felt protected for no rational reason. I guess what I'm trying to say here is, you know, walking around India and understanding for the first time in my life as a white kid from grew up in New York and a beautiful little village 30 miles east out on Long Island, and, you know, very about the sophistication of Leave It to Beaver kind of childhood, happy childhood, fairly simple, a great family, routine trauma. You know, my grandpa died, my dog died, a girl didn't fall in love with me that I fell in love with, but it wasn't until I got out into what we'll call the third world that I realized, number one, how fortunate I was, and how for so many people, that wheel of karma, that idea of coming back is based on not just the wonder of living your life and wanting to live more, but that life is not a fun place to be, and you want to get off that wheel so you can come back in a state where you are in less trouble or dealing with less harsh problems. You know, seeing cremations on the Ganges and pondering the reality of the simple fact, Tim, that no matter what, we can, you know, live quiet lives or, you know, be a Donald Trump, anything in between, but we're all here for only a brief amount of time in this life. We know that for sure. And why not make it count? Why not take rational risks? Why not fight for what you believe in? Why not be, in so many words, one of the good guys when you can be?
Yeah.
And it strikes me the world could be so different in such a positive place, in such a positive way, not if everybody started to do nice things, but if people simply stopped hurting each other or doing things to destroy.
Yeah.
Everything would change dramatically, but that, sadly, is not the world we live in.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?